The Battle for Liberty, Episode 6.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
Good morning and welcome back to the Battle for Liberty. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Tilden. I want to welcome you back to the podcast dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. So glad you're joining us today. Can't wait to get into it, but before we do, I want to remind you, you can always check us out at battleforliberty.com. You can follow me on Twitter at @mybattleliberty, or you can email me at mike@battleforliberty.com. I'd sure love to hear from you. So pick any of those methods and send me your thoughts. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or even TuneIn. Really helps me out, helps me grow my listener base. You could do me one better and tell a friend about the show. I'd sure appreciate that. If you want to check out the show notes for today, as usual, it's going to be battleforliberty.com/6. All right, let's jump right into it. We have a lot to cover today. I'm really excited. It's been a really good week, and I think you're going to enjoy what we're going to be talking about today. So we're going to start out with some news and current events, and the current events I've chosen to speak about this week are the 2016 Summer Olympics. Yes, the Olympics started, and everyone in my household is glued to the television. We cannot get enough of the Olympics. We're big fans in this household, and I posted about this on the website earlier this week. And the reason I felt compelled to write a post about the Olympics is that what I've learned in the libertarian movement is that for some reason, there's a few hardcore circles and a few hardcore people who really have a strong disdain for the Olympics and anyone who seems to garner some sort of enjoyment from them. Having an affinity for the Olympics seems to be anathema to the purest of the stalwarts. And I guess I can understand their point to a certain extent. And if you're new, as most of you probably are if you're listening to this podcast, you need to understand that many libertarians hate the Olympics. Because, of course, the athletes are all playing for their countries. And so some libertarians say that supporting the Olympics only feeds the beast. That is, when you watch or otherwise support the games, you're supporting and affirming the state's control and the state's monopoly. To them, it's like you're blindly pledging allegiance to the state. And of course, that flies in the face of all that is the libertarian movement and the liberty movement. Okay, I guess I can understand that perspective, but I just don't see it that way. Of course, like I said, I recognize all of those issues and I respect them, but we need to be consistent here with our stance on individual preferences. Now, it should go without saying, especially for libertarians, that each individual is going to have differing reasons for their differing tastes. To me, the Olympics are about raw competition. I'm watching the best athletes in the world as they vie for glory and put their talents on display. I gotta tell you, I love the spectacle. I love the memories that I made with my family growing up. We always watched the Olympics together. And I love the memories that I'm making with my children now. We've made it a special thing for us to sit around with my children and watch the Olympics. And it's just been great fun. And now I know there are probably millions of fools out there running around chanting USA, USA, who 99% of the time embody everything that I disdain about the worship of the state and the pledge to the flag. But for a brief moment, for my own sanity, I've chosen to ignore that aspect in life. We gotta have enjoyment every once in a while, folks. And for me, this is one that this is one of those times that I can grab some enjoyment. So, to put it in context, lest you think I'm a raging hypocrite, as you might expect, I've always been just a little bit different when you compare me to my contemporaries when it comes to sports. I was that kid in gym class who, when we were playing floor hockey, I would be just as excited for a good play when it was one of my opponents who made the good play as if it was me. I was a fierce competitor in my own right, but I recognized talent on the other team, and I loved it when I saw it. Now, my favorite sport is ice hockey, and my team is the Philadelphia Flyers. But at the end of the year, when the Flyers are out, and I get a lot of practice saying that, once they're out, I continue to enjoy watching the world's best players compete for that Stanley Cup. So it's no surprise that I would watch the Olympics with the same attitude. Yeah, sure, my team is Team USA, and I do root for them. But even when it's not Team USA that's risen to the challenge, I still get pumped up for it. I mean, there was this Hungarian swimmer who swam for not only a gold medal, but just crushed the world record. Watching her do that was very enjoyable for me. And so for me, it's not all about the worship of the state or the worship of a nation, but rather it's about raw competition. And I think there's a lesson here for newcomers to the movement. And since I'm hoping that there's a lot of new people listening to this podcast and trying to determine whether or not the Liberty Movement is really for them, I want to make sure that we touch on this clearly. If you're new, don't be discouraged by the diversity of opinion within the movement. You may not be accustomed to that. Within some of the other movements that are out there, diversity of opinion is not welcome. You must think what everyone thinks, or you're not welcome. And yeah, some libertarians are rolling their eyes at me for my open admission that I enjoy the Olympics and that I root for Team USA, but that's okay. In this movement, that kind of intellectual diversity is welcomed. In fact, this is the only place where you will truly find it. Now, I respect those who disagree with me on this issue and many other issues, and I trust that they respect me. So, if you're new to the Liberty Movement, if you're dabbing your toes in the water for the first time and you find that there's an aspect of it that you don't agree with, don't turn and run. Relax and be assured. This is the place for you. And with that, I'll leave it there with the Olympics and we'll move on to the main topic of today's episode, and that is unintended consequences. We're going to talk about a very common principle that libertarians talk about today, in unintended consequences. And to start off the segment, I want to quote from Murray Rothbard, who said, "The market promotes and rewards the skills of production and voluntary cooperation. The government enterprise promotes the skills of mass coercion and bureaucratic submission. And those who get to the top will be those with the most skill in that particular task." Now, I think that's a wonderful quote to explain unintended consequences. What Rothbard is saying here is that on one hand, in the private sector, skills of production and cooperation are what are rewarded. But in the government enterprise, it's the skills of coercion and submission. And in either case, what's going to get you to the top in your industry is the skill in those areas. And so to me, that speaks to unintended consequences, because some people may intend to go into government or to utilize government enterprise for good purposes, but they don't realize that in order to get to the top, you must master coercion and you must force submission. Now, some people would argue that that's maybe not an unintended consequence, but again, that's a discussion for another day. So, continuing on with our discussion of unintended consequences, I want to introduce you to what I would call the number one book for anyone who's looking to begin to understand economics. And this book deals with unintended consequences in a way that has changed the way that I've looked at life. And that book is Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. Now, this book was written back in 1946, but it is a monumentally important book, and it is still just as relevant today as it was in 1946 when Hazlitt wrote it. If you are the type of person who thinks economics is too hard or you don't understand it because it's too confusing, Hazlitt is going to convince you otherwise. He is brilliant, and he boils economics down into one simple lesson. The book is divided into two sections. The first section is the one lesson, and it's 4 or 5 pages at the most. The second section of the book is that one lesson applied to scenario after scenario after scenario. It's a great book. If you don't have it, if you've never read it, please go pick it up. You can get it for free at Mises.org. That's Mises.org. You can get that free ebook version at Mises.org. Or if you want a hard copy, I know I like to have hard copies, you can head on over to Amazon, and it's not an expensive book. 10 or 11 bucks brand new. Used, you could probably get it for 3 or 4. So head on over and pick it up. I really recommend it. But let's talk about what Hazlitt's one lesson is. Hazlitt boils economics down into this one sentence, and I'll quote, "The art of economics consists in looking not merely at the immediate, but at the longer effects of any act or policy. It consists in tracing the consequences of that policy not merely for one group, but for all groups," end quote. And if you want to get even simpler than that, you could think of it this way. When you're thinking about any act or policy, you need to look at the bigger picture. That's it. Now, this may seem like the most common of common sense, but you would be amazed at how often, if you're really trained to look at it through that lens, you would be amazed how often, as you walk through your daily life, how often you see examples of policymakers ignoring that one lesson. It's so basic, and it's so simple, but it's so important, and it is so often ignored. What a shame. So this is what brought me to understand unintended consequences at a much deeper level. Because, of course, another way to think of Hazlitt's lesson is that whenever the lesson is ignored, inevitably you will have outcomes that you didn't think of or that were unintended. So that's how I got introduced to it. And what I want to do is I want to go through systematically a couple of classic examples of how the state's policies have returned consequences that were not maybe intended. And these examples that I'm going to bring up are some of the core policy areas that people in the liberty movement tend to focus on. So, being that I want this podcast to speak to the novice, you need to be fully versed and understand where the fallacies in all of these policies arise and how to explain them and combat them. So let's jump right in with the first one, and that first one is what I'm just going to call regulations in general. Now, whether you know it or not, there are countless regulations on the books which have turned out to have horrible unforeseen effects. And I'm going to give an example here that winds up being perfect because on its face, you might think it's a great idea. So this example comes to us from a website called Learn Liberty. And if you've never been there, you should write it down and head on over after you're done listening to the podcast, of course. And it's learnliberty.org. And you don't need to look for the article. I'm going to link to it in the show notes page. But the article is called "A Rule Meant to Reduce Neurosurgeons' Fatigue Went Terribly Wrong." And here's the gist of it. So a couple years back, a rule was put in place that would limit the number of hours that a resident, or that's a doctor in training for those of you who don't know, limit the number of hours that a resident could work in a given week. Now, of course, this had good intentions. The assumption that I think is accepted by a lot of people is that tired doctors make more mistakes. Therefore, if doctors work less, they'll get more rest and then make less mistakes, right? Seems legit. But of course, this regulation comes with some unintended consequences. The crafters of this rule simply weren't looking at all of the broader aspects. And so a landmark study in 2012 found that duty hour restrictions actually caused more complications, believe it or not. Preventable or avoidable bad outcomes increased because of disruptions in continuity of care. That's amazing. This is just something that they didn't think about, but here it is, an unintended consequence right in front of us. What they found is that because each physician works fewer hours, they have to hand off their patients to other doctors, which can lead to mistakes even more serious than the ones that were caused by fatigue in the first place. In addition, the author of the study pointed out that surgeries are more likely to be dropped when hours restrictions are put into place, particularly in neurosurgery, where surgeries can range anywhere from 4 to 10 hours. Restricting hours for the residents means that the residents perform fewer surgeries and they get less experience during their training. So if the resident is close to the duty hour cap, he or she could be faced with this really awful choice. And that is, they could either make the unethical decision to go home, abide by the rules, and miss the opportunity to learn how to do a unique and challenging procedure, or they could make the unethical decision to lie about the duty hours. So damned if you do and damned if you don't. So that's just one example of how a regulation that was meant to do some good wound up actually doing a lot worse. Turns out if you just let these people regulate it themselves, they'd probably figure out the safest way to do it. These are, after all, the people we trust to operate on our brains. I think we can probably trust them to figure this out, right? All right, so that's example number one. It's a short one, but it's powerful, and it has its place here. And at this point, you may be asking yourself, or at least wondering, well, okay, that sounds bad, but that's not the norm. You've just cherry-picked a certain example here. Well, I got news for you. We got two more examples to go through. So example number two I'm going to use for unintended consequences is the minimum wage. And this is a biggie. So let's get right into it. There's a lot that can be said about the minimum wage and all of the unintended consequences that come with it. But I thought for this 30 to 40 minute podcast, I want to focus on something that's recent. And so recently there's been a big push for what people are calling the Fight for 15 movement, which is a movement in the United States right now that is pushing a move to a national $15 an hour minimum wage. Now, that hasn't happened yet, but there are a few localities who have decided to try it at a local level to hopefully push people to pass a national $15 an hour minimum wage. So one of the localities we're going to touch on is Seattle. So in 2014, Seattle passed a piece of legislation which would raise the minimum wage within the city limits to $15 an hour by 2017. Now, currently, the minimum wage is sitting right at $11 an hour, and that's up from $9.32 an hour before the law went into effect. So prior to 2014, it was $9.32. From 2015 till today, which is the August 11th, 2016, it's been $11 an hour. So we've got a little bit of time that we can study to see how did that affect the economy. And it turns out, so far in Seattle, the economy is performing pretty strongly. Wages and employment have both grown at higher than the average rates. And so, of course, the socialists among us are just losing their minds over this. They're so excited. It's being hailed as a victory for the working class and a triumph over evil corporate greed. But let's not kid ourselves. This is an unprecedented hike in what we call a price floor. And so that's going to have some consequences. While most supposedly learned scholars think this is going to help the middle and lower classes, there are, as you might expect, a few unintended consequences. All right, so the article that I'm going to use for this argument comes to us from the Foundation for Economic Education, and the article is called "Seattle's Minimum Wage Hike Didn't Help Low-Wage Workers." And again, it'll be linked over at the show notes page, battleforliberty.com/6. So you don't have to worry about finding it. You just head on over to my website, put a slash and a number 6, and you will be able to find it. So here's what the article is going to tell us that we've been able to find so far about Seattle's minimum wage hike. So first and foremost, they're going to start off by letting us know that a study over at Moody's Analytics showed that simply showing that Seattle's added jobs after the minimum wage hike does not disprove job losses. In order to understand the true effect of the minimum wage increase, it is important to estimate how Seattle's labor market and low-wage workers would have fared if the $11 minimum wage had never been enacted in the first place. Okay, so right there, I mean, that's thick and chewy language there, but I can boil it down to Hazlitt's one lesson. Immediately, already, there's Hazlitt staring us right in the face. What is this guy saying? He's saying that, well, you gotta look at the whole picture. What would have happened if the $11 minimum wage had never been enacted in the first place? That's what we need to be looking at. That's the only way you can tell whether or not this was really as good as everyone thinks it was. So fortunately, there's a University of Washington study that was recently conducted to determine exactly that. And the goal of that study was to predict what would have happened if the minimum wage had never been raised. So here's what they found. They found that the minimum wage had increased wages, as we would have expected, but also that their, quote, best estimates find that the Seattle minimum wage ordinance appears to have lowered employment rates of low-wage workers, end quote. Well, all I can say after that is, whoops. That is not what they were going for, but certainly, here we have an unintended consequence. So the final verdict of that particular study was that the major conclusion one should draw from this analysis is that the Seattle minimum wage ordinance worked as intended by raising the hourly wage rate of low-wage workers, yet the unintended negative side effects on hours and employment muted the impact on labor earnings. Geez, that sounds bad. Well, it gets worse. In addition to that, the article at the Foundation for Economic Education points out that research published out of Texas A&M and MIT found that long-run disemployment effects of minimum wage increases were considerably larger than the much smaller short-run effects. Okay, what does that mean? Well, in all likelihood, what it means is that Seattle has not yet fully experienced the negative consequences resulting from its decision to raise the minimum wage. Gosh, man, that you were right. That really was bad, right? Ugh, I got bad news for you. We're not done yet. So finally, one of the last things in this article is that the University of Washington study, their authors caution that these findings are not generalizable to other cities or regions because, quote, Seattle's strong economy may make it capable of absorbing higher wages for low-wage workers, and this capacity may not be present in other regions. Thus, it's quite likely that other cities following Seattle's lead would experience even worse outcomes than Seattle's less-than-stellar results, end quote. All right. After all of that, all we can do is just go right back to Hazlitt. Of course, the proponents of the Fight for 15 crowd don't ever take into account that lesson. They only think about how the $15 an hour would benefit some of the workers' income, but they don't think about how that would affect the cost of the goods made at those establishments or the other costs of living that will inevitably go up. And they certainly don't think about the long-term effects or how Seattle is a different market than Kansas City and how that's a different market from Denver and how that's a different market from Miami or Washington, D.C. or Charlotte, North Carolina. I could go on and on. Every market is different. But they're only looking at those short-term results in one city and they declare it a victory. So what do you think? What do you think about the $15 minimum wage in general? What do you think about how the minimum wage has unintended consequences. Do you still think that a minimum wage is a good idea at all? Do you think it's a good idea to leave it where it is, to raise it? Give me a tweet at MyBattleLiberty and let me know. Let's have a discussion. All right, so we're going to move on now to the third and final example that I'm going to bring up for unintended consequences, and that is affirmative action. And for this example, we're in luck. I'm going to let the eminent Thomas Sowell explain the perverse and backwards consequences of affirmative action, a policy that was supposed to help blacks climb the economic ladder. And in the following audio clip, you're going to listen to an interview from 1984. And in this interview, Tony Brown interviews Thomas Sowell, and it's Brown that you'll hear first. Now, this interview is old, but it's just as relevant today as it was back in 1984. So let's go ahead and roll that clip.
You make another point in terms of intra-black relations, and that is, you say, affirmative action, for the most part, has really benefited blacks who really didn't need affirmative action.
Oh, affirmative action is a great way for black PhDs to get endowed chairs. It's a terrible way for some kid in the South Bronx to try to get his first job. What affirmative action does is create an incentive for people to hire those who have a proven track record, those who have degrees and things like that. It makes it more dangerous for the employer to hire an untrained person with no track record, because if he has to fire that person, then he's letting himself in for legal trouble. In other words, you can hire a white of very doubtful qualifications, and if he doesn't work out, throw him out in the street the next week. You hire blacks of doubtful qualifications, throw them out in the street the next week, and you've got the NAACP, you've got the EEOC, you've got God knows who all to contend with. The employers have long ago figured this one out, and so they have not hired those blacks who are at all doubtful, either in terms of qualifications or simply not enough experience to know how good they are. You see this in the data. Blacks who have education and who have experience have been moving up on whites and in some cases overtaking whites. If you look at blacks who have not finished high school, blacks who come from background of families that are broken and so forth, they are falling further and further behind, not only further behind the population in general, but further behind whites of this with the same disadvantages.
What do you blame for that? You're not blaming middle-class blacks who are beneficiaries of affirmative action, are you?
I'm blaming the incentives created by affirmative action, because when it comes to the incentives that are created, the businessman is going to try to protect himself whatever way he can, and that means hiring those blacks who are overqualified, who have a long track record, and so on. And that's what all the data show, that the more, for example, black couples where the husband and wife are both college educated now make more money than white couples where the husband and wife are both educated. But the black female-headed family has lost real income in absolute terms over the past several years and has fallen further behind white female-headed families. So the very opposite trends are going on at the same time. And you can't argue this because of blackness or racism, because both of them are black people. One group is shooting way ahead, one is falling further and further behind. And a large part of that reason, I believe, and the data seem to suggest, is because the incentives created by affirmative action and similar kinds of programs just make it too dangerous to take a chance.
Well, as usual, Sowell just nails it. What he's saying here is that for those employers who are in need of low-skilled labor, it's safer for an employer to hire a white person of low skill because if he has to fire him, he has that option. But if he has to fire a black worker of low skill, he could be in a lot of trouble. So for the employer, the safe bet is to hire as many high-skilled blacks as possible because there's less chance he'll have to fire those high-skilled workers, but leave the low-skilled labor to the white employees. So what does this do for a low-skilled black worker? Well, it creates yet another barrier to entry into the labor force and eliminates the possibility that they'll gain valuable work experience and begin to climb the ladder, which of course is the exact opposite of what the program was intended to do in the first place. Once again, an unintended consequence of terrible proportion, all because we didn't keep Hazlitt in mind. All right, well, that does it for the three examples. you know, we've looked at unnecessary regulations, we've looked at minimum wage, and we've looked at affirmative action. And in all three of these classic examples, we see that Hazlitt's one lesson is lingering in the background all the while, shaking its finger at us as if to say, I'm so disappointed. We just don't seem to get it right. Folks, if we can simply keep Hazlitt's lesson at the forefront of our minds, we will be far better prepared to make decisions about our lives and our governance. As usual, the battle for liberty in this respect is to be fought with education. We've got to get the word out about these simple basics of economics that will help us in all aspects of our lives. If you want to fight back with me, share this episode with a friend, find someone who you think could benefit from this information, send them the URL battleforliberty.com/6, and we'll do it together, folks. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, battle on.